Cleveland does not have a gayborhood like the Castro in San Francisco or the West Village in New York. Studio West 117, a $100 million development project on the Cleveland-Lakewood border, wants to change that. With hangout spots, businesses, and housing created by and for the LGBTQ+ community. But some folks who've been involved with the project say it's harming the very community it wants to serve. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Amy Eddings. We'll hear from reporters for Cleveland Scene and the Buckeye Flame, who investigated allegations of mismanagement and unfulfilled promises at Studio West. Plus, how women helped Shamus Malik become Akron's next mayor. And the popular PBS show Antiques Roadshow is filming today at Stan Hewitt Hall. We'll talk about trends in antiquing in Northeast Ohio. The conversation begins after the latest news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Amy Eddings. Thanks so much for joining us. Studio West 117 is a $100 million development project that aims to give Cleveland a gayborhood, a destination neighborhood of LGBTQ+ friendly shops, restaurants, nightclubs, and housing like the Castro in San Francisco, Chelsea in New York, West Hollywood in L.A. The first phase of this ambitious three-year project got underway last October, and developers Daniel Butish and Betsy Figge are, by their own admission, dealing with growing pains. But an investigation by Cleveland Scene's Maria Elena Scott and the Buckeye Flame's Ken Schneck found they've also alienated some members of the community in the process through questionable business decisions, broken promises, and a lack of communication. We kick off the show today with Maria Elena Scott of Cleveland Scene, who joins me in studio. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also in studio is someone you'll often hear Fridays on SOI's Reporters Roundtable, Ken Schneck, the editor and founder of the Buckeye Flame. Welcome back.
Good to see you, Amy.
Ken and Maria Elena were hearing from people in the community even before their piece was published last week. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903, 866-578-0903. You can also email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Later this hour, hear the outsized role women voters played last month in the Akron mayoral race. And Antiques Roadshow is filming its popular PBS show in Akron today. We'll talk about Northeast Ohio's antique scene. But first, Studio West 117, or Studio West. Ken, give us a sense of the scope and scale of this project. Has anything like this been done before?
I have never seen anything like this. You know, you and I have both lived in New York City, and so we are quite familiar with an LGBTQ scene in a neighborhood. I tell anyone who will listen that this is an awe-inspiring project. Maria Elena and I have both taken tours of the facility. You can bruise your jaw from the amount of times that it just drops because the scope of it is so incredible and quite frankly, so inspiring. And so we're in phase one right now where there are a few different restaurants and the only rooftop bar in Lakewood and a whole gymnasium facility. Phase two is the rehabbing of the old fantasy complex with the pirate ship in there, and they are keeping the pirate ship, and a midnight of garden of good and evil kind of brunch spot, like a gothic spot and a fetish bar. And then phase three is going to be a hotel. That's the plan, a hotel, possibly a place for people to recover from trans surgeries, kind of like a Ronald McDonald House, senior living. So it is an awe-inspiring project.
And so tell me, give me a sense of how you learned there were concerns about the project from members of the LGBTQ+ community.
Sure. I had been hearing stuff for the past year, just assorted little things about there's something going on with a nonprofit that they created or some people are frustrated. But quite frankly, you know, the Buckeye Flame is trying to cover the entire state, Amy. It just wasn't a priority for me until I went to dinner with another journalist and one of the individuals who's interviewed in the article. And that individual was talking about their experiences working for Studio West, and they used the phrase, they're doing harm to, in that context, to the drag community. And that was one of those, oh, you can't unring that bell. And I remember going to sleep that night thinking, you kind of have to follow up on this. So I did some storyboarding the next day, like kind of Amy Eddings. I've seen your storyboards before, Amy Eddings. They are quite extensive. And so I did that. And what immediately became clear to me as I started mapping out the different things that I was hearing was, one, there's absolutely no way I can do this by myself just because of the scope of all the different things I'm hearing. And two, I shouldn't be doing it by myself because I am a member of this community. I am a member of the LGBTQ community. And so I need to bring in someone else, another journalist who can bring some perspective to this and maybe say, no, Ken, that doesn't sound right. And so I reached out to Cleveland Scene, and that's how Maria Elena and I met for the first time.
So Maria Elena, based on what I read in the article, a lot of the problems seem to stem from Studio West's relationship with Beautish's and Figgy's nonprofit foundation, West 117 Foundation. Tell me a little bit about that, and also tell me who Daniel Beautish and Betsy Figgy are.
Yeah, so Daniel Beautish and Betsy Figgy have known each other for a while now. They have a background in tax credit, real estate, development stuff. They don't have a background as much in community development and nonprofit organization. So I think sort of this core group of Figgy, Boudish, Lauren Tatum, who is the president of the board of the West 117 Foundation, her partner, and Dr. Lady J, all sort of had this
a renowned yes. drag performer out of Texas, has a PhD,
an actual doctor,
yes. Yes. doctor in
who
drag.
Was quoted this week in National Geographic
yes.
for
oh.
their work. Yeah,
wow. And just a little asterisk here: Daniel Beautish is the son of former Cuyahoga County Executive Armand Beautish. So, yes,
former Speaker of the House,
former
yes.
Speaker
yeah.
of the House in Ohio. So, please continue.
So this core group sort of had this idea for, you know, engaging with Cleveland's LGBTQ plus community and creating sort of a gayborhood and a support system for the community. And so out of this idea was born the for-profit side, which is Studio West, and the nonprofit, which was the West 117th Foundation. But that relationship sort of soured very quickly. To hear Boudish and Figgy tell it, the nonprofit just wasn't moving at the speed that a development happening like this needed, but to hear folks from the nonprofit side, their autonomy as a board, as an organization, was not being respected.
So this foundation was to raise funds to support services that were going to be hosted by Studio West?
So that is sort of the idea that you get speaking to Lauren Tatum, speaking to former director Steve Socaney, that Boudish and Figgy had this idea. But they maintained that it was supposed to be an autonomous nonprofit organization with a few major components, one of which was a grant program. But they maintained that it wasn't there just to rubber stamp applications for grant funding for Studio West 117th, that it had its own process, its own board to go through grants.
Got it. And there was a lot of transition on the foundation board.
Yes. Yeah. So of the 11 original board members, and I believe two ex officio members, there are just three remaining board members.
And is there a relationship between the foundation and Studio West today?
They have completely separated at this point. Oh. So many of the board members who have left told us in a statement that they left because of sort of petty disagreements between the two entities and other leadership at the nonprofit sort of being unable to get past personal squabbles with the leadership of the for-profit side.
Personalities before principles, ah, yes. Ken, let's get to some specifics. The article opens with the story of a barber named Ariana Perez, who had an idea for a themed barbershop that I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Tell me about her business idea.
Barber Cult. It was kind of a combination. Ariana specializes in fades, fade haircuts, but also bringing in kind of an occult vibe to the barbershop as well. And so she really was one of the first people that we spoke to. And I met with her as she was cutting someone's hair. She was finishing up a haircut, but not in her space in Studio West. It was in a space in Lakewood because her space for which she signed a 10-year lease, which was, you know, some say is a little bit out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
She's a first-time Latina business owner. And by her own admission, she said, wow, I really should not have signed that lease. I should have had a lawyer look at this. Her space in Studio West, it was a temporary space as they were building out something else for her in this construction zone, was completely ruined. And there's pictures in the article. The ceiling caved in. Another part of the lease that she signed, which she regrets, says any damage done to the space is her responsibility. All of her equipment was ruined. She has a list of thousands of dollars of equipment that was ruined. There was also another part of the lease, Amy, that said any hiring decisions that she makes, because there's a copy of the lease that she provided with us that we published, any hiring decisions that she makes has to be vetted through a hiring committee from Studio West. So not something that you would normally see in someone who's leasing out a space. So she is still currently stuck in her 10-year release. In an email that Budish and Figgy sent to her, which we also published, they said to her, we will let you out of this 10-year lease if you sign a non-disclosure or non-disparagement agreement, which seems to be a little bit of the norm for people who have worked there. Now, in Budish and Figgy's defense, they have not been charging her rent. So whereas Ariana has characterized this relationship as predatorial, their quote was, how could this possibly be predatorial when we're not charging her for this space or for utilities? So while all of this is going on, she is not actually in the space for mm-hmm. which she has a 10-year lease.
And my understanding, too, and explain this also in she was also provided with a grant application for the foundation.
Yeah, so that part's a little bit tricky. So Ariana told us that she was handed a pre-filled out grant application from the foundation and was told when that grant is approved, that money would be given straight back to Studio West. We asked Budish and Figgy specifically about that, and their response was, we are always there to help the folks that are leasing out space from us. They didn't address that head on. And certainly, as we talked to Maria-Lane and I both talked to former board members, that was one of the bones of contention was, is there understanding about the relationship between a nonprofit and a for-profit? Since the two entities have divorced, Budish and Figgy have started two new nonprofits so that they now have two new ones that are affiliated with Studio West.
And again, this is where the board members of the foundation thought, hey, wait a minute, we're supposed to rubber stamp these applications coming in. You're infringing on our autonomy. So these blurred lines between the foundation and Studio West.
Yes. And again, Budish and Figgy were up front, and their background is not in nonprofit management. And so some of the board members with whom we both spoke said, there was a learning curve. There was a learning curve that needed to happen. And Budish and Figgy had their own lawyer. And so there just was stuff that needed to be figured out.
And again, we welcome you to join the conversation. Call 866-578-0903. You can also send us an email at soi@ideastream.org or tweet at us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Maria-Elena, another specific situation was about a youth league, an LGBTQ plus youth league that was to be formed. Tell me that story there. You know, this comes against a backdrop of legislation in Ohio, across the nation, against trans youth's participation in sports, in student athletics. So tell me about this youth league that was going to be formed.
Yeah, so this was another major branch of the foundation. It was going to be a grant program. It was going to be an art mural project and a youth sports league, which was going to be open to kids of all sexual orientations, and really was supposed to be sort of a safe haven for kids, especially amid this backdrop of very frightening legislation for LGBTQ plus children. And so the original idea was that it was going to be hosted in the Fieldhouse at Studio West.
And the Fieldhouse is a gymnasium.
It is, yeah. Yes.
And it's open, right? It opened mm-hmm. in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pickleball, spinning classes. There's quite a bit going on there in the gymnasium.
Mm-hmm. Free of charge. And so it was sort of to be a collaboration between these two entities. As the relationship between the two sort of fell apart, this was another point of contention. Gio Santiago, who sort of ran the youth sports league for the foundation, says that they were really unable to have a guarantee that they'd be able to use this space. Now, the Studio West developers say that's not true. We never boot pre-existing engagements out. But if there was, you know, an event like Pride that was going to be using the space, we'd have to arrange something else for that week. So again, these sort of warring narratives. Mm. But by the time the foundation and Studio West sort of completely separated, the Youth Sports League, they ended up partnering with Lakewood Schools. It was hosted elsewhere, never had anything to do with Studio West. Then Studio West started the youth basketball program in the Fieldhouse. So this program that had been advertised as a youth athletics program in the Fieldhouse, now there was another youth athletics program in the Fieldhouse. So to hear Santiago and the foundation side of the story, they say this was intentionally misleading, that, you know, members of the community, that community partners, had heard about a youth athletics program that would be in the Fieldhouse. Now, if you Google
run
that,
by a nonprofit,
exactly,
service oriented, free of charge,
yes.
And now we're having this youth basketball league that ostensibly you
yes.
pay a fee for,
correct?
Yes.
Okay, gotcha. Dan from Lakewood called us earlier. He didn't want to come on the air, but his comment is there enough of a community to support this large-scale project, or a community that will show up?
Sure. Yeah, and Dan Budish, they had some amazing write-ups in both the New York Times, Yahoo News, and in all the media attention for this again, an awe-inspiring project. The idea was it wasn't just going to be for the Cleveland LGBTQ community, the Northeast Ohio LGBTQ community, but it would become a destination, that it would be a place to which LGBTQ people from around the country would go, or maybe, you know, with the conferences that we're increasingly getting in Cleveland, that there would be an LGBTQ night out at Studio West. Certainly with Phase 3 being a hotel, I think that would increase the capacity. That would obviously increase the capacity for LGBTQ people to make it a destination. But that was the idea, is that Dan Budish has said that so many people leave Cleveland, so many LGBTQ people leave Cleveland because we don't have this. So it would both retain people and attract people.
And didn't Cleveland host the Gay Games?
We sure did, 2014. And it is the only Gay Games. And Steve Socaney, who was the executive director of the foundation, was a huge player in the Gay Games. The 2014 Gay Games that was hosted in both Cleveland and Akron, the only Gay Games to ever be hosted in two places, the only Gay Games to ever have a sitting president address the assembled masses, President Obama address them, and the only, and I think this is the key piece, the only Gay Games to ever turn a profit. It is the only one to never lose money, that it didn't lose money.
Here in Northeast Ohio.
That's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
Yeah.
Again, we are happy to take your calls or your texts or your tweets. We're at Sound of Ideas on Twitter. You can text us at 216-916-6478 or call us at 866-578-0903. Ken, how have Daniel Budish and Betsy Figge responded to the complaints and allegations you've reported?
That's a great question. So we certainly went back to them with things from throughout the article. And, you know, they were very quick to say that they have hired over 70 people, to which our follow-up question was, great, how many still work there? To which their response was, we will not comment on personnel decisions. And so we, a lot of the responses were, we will not comment on personnel decisions. I don't know. I guess as a journalist, I find a couple of the responses surprising. You know, one of the things that came up repeatedly from employees was that there is working there a manager that some employees have described as making homophobic comments or transphobic comments or being a little predatory. And we went back to, of course, went back to Daniel and Betsy and said, hey, this is what we're hearing. And the response we received back was, we have not witnessed any of that behavior. So Maria Elena sat down with them for an extended amount of time. We then sent them many follow-up questions. And so I think the key piece for us was just that there not be surprises, that we shared with them. Hey, so folks are saying that there's a lot of NDAs, that people are signing non-disparagement agreements all over the place. And what about this 10-year lease? And their response was, we don't do NDAs. And we don't do 10-year leases. So we had a little bit of a tough time squaring up the responses from employees. And also just not having this be a piece that's about disgruntled folks. Again, the central narrative here was people stepping forward to say, we're trying to create this LGBTQ epicenter, but for some of us within the LGBTQ community, many of us Black, Brown, trans, it's pushing us farther apart. One of the elements that I found particularly salient was that which affected the drag community. And so drag artists, they have a resident cast there. And many drag artists who don't work there, we spoke with, who said, I just don't even understand who's chosen to work there, how you can get in there, with other drag artists from other bars saying that our ideas were stolen and replicated at Studio West. Dan and Betsy responded that we encourage our producers to be out there and finding the best ideas possible.
Have the complaints and concerns you've articulated eroded overall support for Studio West?
I know this isn't a satisfactory answer, but in some ways my answer is I hope not. There is not a single person with whom either of us spoke, not a single person who doesn't want the project to succeed.
Even people who complained about their interactions
with... Even
people
came in, Dr. Lady J, people who have worked there have said, this felt like a lot, right? It was, the scope was almost difficult to wrap my mind around, but it's so inspiring. It drew me in. And so people want this to succeed. I think, you know, it's unfortunate that people walk away with the impression that this is some sort of hit piece or what. No, everyone wants this facility to succeed. It would be amazing for Cleveland if it does. Pause. They also want some of the managerial practices and some of the programming and just some of the way that the community is engaged to change. I think some people, including the foundation side, people who've worked there, just want a listening tour, want the opportunity to provide feedback. Some responses online have been, you know, people know Daniel and Betsy, you can just talk to them. Every single person with whom we spoke said to us, we tried.
Hmm. So in wrapping up, Maria Elena, where do you see this project going, or perhaps you're reporting on this project? Next steps, what will you be looking for as Studio West 117 moves forward?
So I think the biggest thing is how the employees, how the contractors are treated and, you know, feel going forward. Like Ken said, everyone that we've spoken to is 100% supportive of the project, but there are these recurring contentions that time will tell if steps are taken. The foundation side of things, they have said that they intend to change their name to further separate, but even in the foundation, everyone says it's such a great idea. The community is so important and so frequently underserved, but these changes have to happen going forward.
Ken, this article got 24,000 hits
on our site,
on
and
the
then
Buckeye
on
Flames
quite a,
website,
quite a bit, on Cleveland Scene as well.
What has been the response?
A little bit all over the place. You know, I think that it was surprising to people, and I'll use that word for right this second, that there would be a piece that would be in any way critical about an LGBTQ effort with voices who are being critical. The article itself wasn't attempting to be critical. It was just attempting to amplify these voices at this time when we have so much anti-LGBTQ legislation. The confluence of timing wasn't wonderful. The piece actually was released on May 31st, and not a single person said a word about Pride Month. People were focused on the piece. The next day, Scene had an Instagram post with the cover, and then the conversation shifted to, how could you put this out there on the first day of Pride Month when the day before that wasn't the conversation at all? I think what's particularly, if I can just say, frustrating to me and seeing some of the responses is folks making it seem like it's straight people coming after the LGBTQ community. Look what, you know, this is just another example of folks trying to suppress LGBTQ voices. And that's not what this piece is at all. This piece is amplifying LGBTQ voices, many of them historically marginalized, who are stepping up to say, here's the experience that we're having with these two developers. And so the call is coming from inside the house, and we need to note that. I will just say it was a particularly, I said this to Maria Elena a lot, and anyone who will listen, this is one of the most depressing pieces I've ever worked on, mm-hmm. just as a member of the LGBTQ community. As I said at the top, this isn't something that I want to be focusing on. But when people step forward to say, I was harmed here. My voice is being suppressed. That's important for us to talk about accountability within the LGBTQ community, just as we're writing articles every other day of the week about what's coming out of the Columbus State House.
Ken Schneck is editor and founder of the Buckeye Flame. Maria Elena Scott is a reporter for Cleveland Scene. You can find their stories on both their websites. Thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate you.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks for having us.
A new poll shows Akron women voters single-handedly elected Shamus Malik as the presumptive next mayor of Akron. More on what the poll says about Malik's decisive victory in the May Democratic mayoral primary after the break. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Amy Eddings. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Amy Eddings. Thanks so much for tuning in. Akron City Councilmember Shamus Malik, Akron's presumptive mayor, succeeded in the seven-way Democratic mayoral primary because of women. New post-election polling shows women made up 65% of the broad and diverse coalition that gave Malik a decisive victory. What was it about his message that was so appealing to women? Joining me to talk about the poll a bit more and what it says about how the 32-year-old Muslim American and first-term city councilman won the race is IdeaStream Public Media's Anna Huntsman, who reports on Akron. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Anna's joined by reporter Doug Livingston with the Akron Beacon Journal, which co-sponsored the poll. Welcome back to The Sound of Ideas, Doug.
Good morning.
If you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903. Email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. I'd especially love to hear from Akron women who were undecided going up to like the last couple of weeks before the May primary, before they decided to choose to vote for Shamus Malik. What was it that helped make your decision? Anna, I'll start with you. Let's dig into those numbers. How strong was Malik's support among women?
Amy, it was really strong. So if you look at, according to the survey, of the people who said that they voted for Shamus Malik, 65% of them were women. So if you kind of do the math, and the survey was done of 500 registered voters, but it was weighted to try to reflect the actual voting population. So if you would do the math and kind of convert this when you look at voter turnout, that equates to about 5,994 women who voted for him. That's compared to 4,995 people across the board combined who voted for Deputy Mayor Marco Somerville, who came in second. So again, doing the math here, a single, even if not a single man voted for Shamas Malik, he still would have won just because of the overwhelming support from women. So this was something that surprised some of the people who analyzed the poll. Not a huge surprise necessarily. However, it was, you know, quite impressive to see just how many women showed up.
Anna, what was it about Malik's message that resonated with Akron women? Did you get any sense of that from the poll? I'm thinking of this especially since voters had a woman on the ballot, yeah. Councilwoman Tara Mosley, to vote for.
Right. I mean, I think that was kind of what did surprise some of the people who analyzed the survey is, I mean, I guess everybody expected that, you know, Tara Mosley would get a lot of the women voters. But John Green, he's the director emeritus of the University of Akron's Ray C. Bliss Institute for Applied Politics. He helped develop the poll. He has analyzed all the polls. Again, he said this was surprising, but some of the things that he said are that women tend to be a big part of the progressive voting block. And Malik was one of the most progressive candidates of the seven. He and Tara Mosley were highly regarded as the most progressive. You know, he's always talking about change. That was his big message, is change for Akron. He's always, you know, calling for police reform. He is absolutely one of the most progressive that ran in the race, and so that could be one of the reasons. It's also possible that his campaign style was attractive to women. He's, again, talking about progressive things, but a lot of things about inclusion and getting everyone on board and being transparent. And so that's perhaps one of the other reasons. I will say, too, not that every woman wants this, but Shamas Malik is a very approachable person. He's very easy to talk to. Just kind of seems to have a good demeanor at all times. And that's not, again, not to say that all women want that when they're looking at politicians, but that's
I want
just
a friendly mayor. I'm voting for
sure,
the friendliest.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I don't know
candidate.
That everybody wants, you know, man or woman. I hope everybody wants someone to be friendly, but that's just something else I've observed.
Doug, women were the largest percentage of a broad coalition of voters who went with Malik. What can you tell me about the other demographic groups he appealed to?
Sure. So this was the third poll, and we had some reading, although there was a tremendous amount of undecided voters heading into the election. About a month out, we knew that about a third of the voters, according to a survey, had yet to decide who they were going to vote for. But the early indication is that Shamas was not going to do well with the black vote. And it turns out he did just as well with the black voters as Marco Somerville, who came in second place. So that was kind of a surprise.
Who's
as well.
An African American? Yeah.
Yes, yes. And the polling numbers on the third place candidate Tara Mosley are kind of hard to read. They get problematic because the numbers get so low, the fewer respondents you get for specific candidates. But we know that Tara Mosley also got a considerable number of the black vote that was spread out across the remaining five candidates, so outside of those who voted for Shamas or Marco. And also the minority vote that did not include black voters, so the Asian, Bhutanese, there are Hispanic population in Akron. This group really overwhelmingly went for Shamas, even more so than women did.
And age, too. Who did he appeal to age-wise? Was it primarily young Akron voters? Tell me about that.
Well, young Akron voters make up a small slice of the electorate, and that's pretty standard across the nation. The 18 to 24 group doesn't turn out as much as, say, the 45 to 64 or the 65 and older group. And Shamas did very well with the seniors. So with 65 and up, he was doing well heading into the election, and the post-election survey shows that he did tremendously well. And if you put all these numbers together, it kind of makes sense that he did so well with women. Women are healthier. They live longer. They make up a smaller portion. They're about 51% of the population compared to men, about 49%. And then you look at the fact that the older voters turn out at much higher frequencies. And older voters, because women are healthier, tend to be female more so. So so I just want to echo some of those reasons that Anna mentioned. And this question was put to Shamas yesterday about why women voted for him in such great numbers. And I think it was that message of systemic change, or what Professor Emeritus John Green would say, the the progressive view that women are the backbone of the progressive voting bloc. Mm. Shamus's message of systemic change and him linking that yesterday at an Akron Press Club luncheon to the challenges that women have faced and continue to face to achieve equality and parity with men, either in the workplace or in society in general. You know, Shamus, he is polite. I've never seen his blood boil in council. He has stood his ground on issues, but even with people he's went toe-to-toe with, I don't think I've ever heard him say a cross word.
Anna, in the 3 minutes we have left, I want to switch to that Akron Press Club program yesterday that Doug was talking about. It featured the presumed mayor. What did he have to say about the poll results?
Yeah, as Doug was saying, he was asked, Moloch was asked right off the bat about this, the women numbers. And I will say that in the audience, a lot of women started cheering and raising their hands. It was actually quite a funny moment, too. And he was kind of smiling and joking about it. But he, in addition to talking about how his message is about systemic change and perhaps that appeal to women, he did make an interesting observation on the campaign trail.
Now, anecdotally, we were very aware of this during the campaign. I cannot tell you how many times I would go to someone on the campaign team and say, you know, I went to this man and he said, you know, I'm not sure, but you got my wife's vote.
So he was hearing this on the campaign trail. And Doug, I know you talked about, you know, there were like a third of undecided voters about 2 months out before the May primary, and Moloch did an extensive door-to-door effort that seemed to flip those undecided voters primarily his way.
Yeah, I know that of the undecided voters, their demographic breakdown was more white than black. So it was white voters that were holding out to the end, not making up their mind until the last minute. And I had heard from voters at the early voting center prior to Election Day that it was, if it was a choice between Marco Somerville or anybody else, it was either vote for or against Marco. And if that was their decision heading into the ballot box, then they had to decide whether to vote for Shamus Moloch or Tara Mosley, because those two had the best choice. So while Tara appeared to have very strong support, very strong base of female support in her voting and the people saying that they would support her, the results look like women really broke for Shamus at the last minute.
Anna, Moloch also made a comment saying he's not satisfied with the grand jury's decision not to indict the 8 officers who fatally shot Jaylen Walker. Let's take a listen.
I was really humbled and thankful to see that even people who didn't vote for me are optimistic, right? Because I talked a lot about how we need change in our community, but I always wanted that to be a positive message.
Well, that was a different comment where he was talking about something that the survey found, which was that even people who didn't vote for him are very optimistic about his future and whether he'll be able to make change in Akron. But yes, regarding the grand jury decision, the survey did ask people whether they were satisfied, whether they were aware of it. And it found that 60% of people surveyed were not satisfied with the grand jury's decision, and he said he isn't either. He did say that he respects the decision as an attorney. He understands what goes into this, but he said he's not satisfied with it. And when he looks at the body cam footage where you can hear and see the dozens of shots fired, he said, since the beginning, I've thought that that was wrong and that there needs to be systemic change in the department.
In the minute we have left, I want to ask this. Moloch's decisive victory and his broad coalition show Akron is hungry for change. Doug, what do you think he will need to do in his first year in office to signal that he's doing what he said he would do?
I think he's going to have to carry through on his promise of opening up government, keeping it transparent, more community engagement. He commended Mayor Dan Horgan for, you know, engaging in a software platform that should hopefully allow the public to weigh in before government acts. And he also, you know, gave a nod to Mayor Justin Bibb in Cleveland, who has kind of kept an online goal tracker of all the campaign promises he's made. So I think we'll see Shamus Malik be more open, and if he can get the community to buy in, and that's really where getting the programs that government wants to implement to get them to work, you've got to get the public behind them, because Mayor Dan Horrigan, the two police chiefs that he's had under him, they've all asked repeatedly for the public's help on these really really tall tasks, these big challenges facing the city.
And Anna, briefly, what would you add to that? What does Malik need to do in his first year?
I mean, I think Doug summed it up really well. But again, I mean, he was talking yesterday about people being willing to hold him accountable. He wants to be more transparent. And so I think just continuing to get people involved and asking for the public's input. I think even just saying, we want your input is good. So I think absolutely.
Anna Huntsman reports on Akron for WKSU IdeaStream Public Media. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you.
And Doug Livingston is a reporter with the Akron Beacon Journal. Thank you, Doug.
Thanks. Take care.
Time for a final break, but when we return, PBS's Antiques Roadshow is taping in Akron today. I'll be there later this afternoon. Hear about Northeast Ohio's antique scene and find out what's trendy now. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Amy Eddings. We'll be right back. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Amy Eddings. The long-running Antiques Roadshow on PBS is taping today at Stan Hewitt Holland Gardens in Akron. And if you don't have a ticket but do have the antiques buzz, we thought we'd end today's show by learning about Northeast Ohio's antique scene. Joining me are two veterans in the antiques and vintage business. Nancy Schaffer is the owner of Copper Kettle Antiques Mall in Ravenna. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas, Nancy.
Thank you very much.
And Wendy Manfredi is a vendor at Sweet Lorraine, a vintage and thrift store in Cleveland's Detroit Shoreway neighborhood. Welcome to the show, Wendy.
Oh, thank you, Amy. Glad to be here.
Listeners, we'd love to add some of your questions or comments. Are you having trouble giving away your antiques or family heirlooms to the next generation? Are you turning to antique stores for help? If you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903 or email us at soi@ideastream.org. Wendy, I'll start with you. When does vintage become antique?
Well, I think it's kind of a viral thing. Antique is, I believe, from what I understand, is usually considered like 50 years old. And what is currently in vogue is probably approaching antique, because your mid-century modern, your 60s, your 50s are, you know, they're definitely in that vein. I think the buzz word is more vintage now than where it used to be. Antique shops now, it's kind of vintage shops or vintage / antique. I think the word just, it seems to work better with people.
Okay.
It doesn't seem like it's ancient, but it's cool.
It's cool, right. Sweet Lorraine has been in business for 31 years. You've been a vendor there for the last 25. What got you started?
Well, really my love of vintage clothing. I did vintage clothing from when I was in my 20s. I've loved it always. And I was a fashion major in college and was kind of inspired by vintage clothing and just always had kind of a buzz for that. And I wanted to kind of curate and keep that going. And then when the opportunity arose, I became a vendor, and I like to talk to people about the vintage clothing that they're getting, try to, you know, suit their tastes and their body styles with the right era that makes them not only feel good, but look good.
Oh, really?
And, so I just enjoy that.
Maybe the 1940s padded shoulder works on some people and not on others.
Exactly. And the slim 60s doesn't work on everybody either.
Oh, that's for sure.
I'm one of them.
Nancy, you've also been in business for 28 years. How did you get interested in antiques and collectibles?
I started with my grandfather's barrister bookcase. I fell in love with it as a child, and the books inside of it, they were all written in Arabic. He was born in Lebanon, and I was fascinated with the old books.
Wow. Are books your major collection in your store?
Yes, we sell many old books. Even young people are buying old books. They're just wonderful treasures.
What changes have you seen in the industry? When you started, were there more antiques shops in the neighborhood?
Yes. At downtown Ravenna, where I'm located, had about a dozen shops. And they're all gone except me, and a new one has opened up, the corner station. But the only reason I made it through the recession and the pandemic was because I have a mall, and I rent space to 18 other diehard junkers like myself.
Okay. Wendy, let me ask you this, Nancy, and then I'll pivot to you, Wendy. You mentioned the pandemic, and certainly that shut down a lot of stores. But I'm wondering if Facebook Marketplace and eBay have eroded in-store sales for antiques and vintage stores.
Yes, definitely it has, yes. And people selling things online and putting outrageous prices on them. Like yesterday, I saw some Corningware listed for $9,000.
What?
You know, Corningware that we sell in my shop for $15 to $25. It really puts the kibosh on traffic sometimes, and it's hard to buy things because people believe these outrageous prices and think that you should pay them that.
Wow. Wendy, what do you think? What do you think about Facebook Marketplace and eBay?
Oh yes, I totally agree with Nancy. The inflated prices that people ask is what people are looking at, but you also have to look at what it sells for, or did it in fact ever sell?
Right.
And people don't do that. They go, "This was listed on Facebook." Yeah, it is hurting the being able to buy good things at a good price, and that's unfortunate because those values aren't real.
And where do you go to get your material? Are you going to eBay and Facebook, or are you? I know when I moved from my big Queen Anne Victorian house in rural Ada, Ohio, we sold most of our furniture at the Plain City Auction near Columbus. So do you do that? Do you go to auctions?
I don't do a lot of auctions. I go to the traditional house sales. I also go to the thrift stores. I have an eye for the fabric, and I kind of run my hand along the aisle or the clothes in the aisle just to kind of get a feel of the fabric, and you can almost find vintage that way. Hmm. Same thing with jeans. Older jeans are tough, and they don't have any stretch to them, and so you just can kind of scope it out really quickly and do that. I'll do garage sales, thrift shops, and since a lot of friends know that I do this, I do have a little mini network of my own where people go, "Hey, a friend of mine has da 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 da. Would you be interested?" And so I kind of get it that way. I don't purchase things online. No.
So would you ever go to Nancy's store and get something there and sell it at your shop?
Likely not. I think probably. I mean, there could be that possibility that there would be a find that, somebody was, trying to blow out a collection of this or that, and I could get it at a good deal. But it's hard to shop at someone's shop and then resell it because, they have fair prices on it. And I shop at other shops for myself, you know, just to wear things myself or decorate my own home. But generally for the resale, I'm going to the house sale, the thrift shop, or, friends. And people come, for example, to Sweet Lorraine. They call in and they say, my grandmother has passed away and I'd like to bring these things in. So.
Yeah, I'd like to get to that in the few minutes we have left. Nancy, a lot of elderly people worry about what is going to happen to their cherished possessions. Has this always been the case, or do you think this is a 21st century condition brought on by IKEA and West Elm? It's easier to buy something new than repurpose mom's early American dining room set.
I don't really think it's because it's easier. Young people, most of them, don't like mom and dad's and grandma's old furniture. They prefer IKEA and the more modern things. And a lot of them, when they inherit things like family pictures and paper, are willing to part with them for the cash. You know, it's sentimental value has diminished over the years. I, in fact, try to talk young people out of it, like selling grandpa's pocket watch. I said, someday you're going to regret it if you sell this today. Hmm. You're going to wish you hadn't done it.
Nancy Schaffer is the owner of Copper Kettle Antiques Mall in Ravenna. Wendy Manfredi is a vendor at Sweet Lorraine in Cleveland's Detroit Shoreway neighborhood. Check out their stores if you can, if you're interested in antiquing. Nancy, Wendy, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter @SoundOfIdeas, and you can follow me @AEddings. We got a lot of comments from listeners about yesterday's topic on electricity rates going up. Jonathan in Euclid sent in this email. We have 24 solar panels on our home in Euclid and have reached out to First Energy to ask if our sellback rates have gone up proportionately, but have not heard back. Shopping for a new supplier, however, because of the solar panels, we've hit a roadblock, as most suppliers won't allow us to sell our excess energy back. Thank you for your comments. If you missed any portion of this program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. I'm Amy Eddings. I'll be back in the Morning Edition chair tomorrow. Thanks for joining me.